But we're going to turn now to our Bibles and to our scripture reading this morning. We're studying together in the Old Testament in the book of Ecclesiastes. And we come this morning to chapter 4, and we're going to read this chapter together. The preacher, Kohelet, is his title in Hebrew. Ecclesiastes, in Greek, that's where we get the name from, means the preacher, the one who gathers people to listen to the wisdom of God as he teaches it to us. And the preacher is a great realist. He is looking at the world, the real world, as it actually is, not the world we would like it to be or pretend it to be. He's observing it. He's looking at it shrewdly. And he is forcing people, and particularly God's people, it is written to the people of God, but all people, to take heed to the reality of the world, the reality of our lives, and to ask hard and difficult questions as to how we're living and whether that is wise and true, whether it leads anywhere, or whether, as so often he concludes, it is just vanity and chasing the wind. So again, he says in chapter 4, verse 1, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors was power, and there was none to comfort them. And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, has not yet seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. And then I saw that all toil and skill, or better, success or achievement, all toil and success in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. And this also is a vanity, a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is one handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and striving after wind. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, literally no second person, either son or brother. And yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity. An unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. If they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who's alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will quickly withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better, it's the third better we've come to, better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he himself went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he'd been born poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun. This verse is not translated well in our version here. Let me read it slightly differently. I saw all the living who move about under the sun were with the second youth who was to stand in his place. Speaking now about a second king coming to replace that first one who's become old and foolish. There was no end of all the people whom he led, and yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity, a striving after wind. Amen. May God help us to hear and to understand these challenging words as we'll come to them shortly. Well, do turn with me, if you would, to Ecclesiastes chapter 4, to the passage that we read together, which is all about the oppression of striving for success in this world. Now we're getting to know Qohelet, the preacher who addresses us in this book, in this very searching book. And he's certainly a persistent and a penetrating preacher. He wants to engage our minds. He wants to make us think and think deeply about God, about life, about the world, about ourselves. And that's good. That's above all what we need in any preaching, in fact. Not sound bites, not stories, not spiritual pick-me-ups. That's often what people want. That's often what preachers attempt to, therefore, to give them, because they want to be popular, they want approval, they want praise. But that is not what people need. And the preacher in this book forces us to think by confronting us with the really big questions that actually we do need to address in life. And we saw that last time in chapter 3, which poses for us this great paradox that we are made as human beings for eternity, and yet we're trapped in a world of time, which does have, therefore, a time for everything, including, as chapter 3, verse 19 says, a time to die. And we will all die very starkly, just like the beasts do. And the key to life, according to the preacher, is recognizing that reality, not trying to resist it. The reality that our lives are ephemeral, that they are vain, that they're fleeting and uncontrollable. And that we need to learn to live with mortality that we simply cannot control. We need to accept that, because paradoxically, it is only accepting that and making peace with that that will actually liberate us for the joy that there is, even in this fleeting life. As the last verse of chapter 3 there says, you see, there is a way of rejoicing in all of our work and seeing that as our reward. That is his reward, not that is his lot. That's his reward. Knowing, you see, that we're in time for eternity lets us perceive, well, as verses 12 and 13 we saw in chapter 3 tells us, that there can be joy as long as you live. And real pleasure, even in this world of toil. That is God's gift to man, says the preacher. And we can have that in time because we know that the best is yet to be. And that liberates us for every joy that is possible now in this time as we live before God on this earth, as we live rejoicing in the life that we have and in the knowledge of the life that is to come. But you see, our world, for the most part, doesn't want to recognize that truth. Won't see it. Won't see that lasting reward, that real gain and profit, can only be found above the sun. And so people devote themselves to living as if this passing world under the sun was everything. So they're driven to seek success and security now in defiance of our mortality. Desiring to strive for success, for identity, for recognition in the achievements, the successes of this passing life. And that is a very oppressive way to live. The real key to life, according to Jesus Christ, indeed according to the whole Bible, hangs on this. Love God with all your heart and soul and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. But refuse, you see, to love God like that, and the truth is, you will also end up living hating your neighbor as well. And that leads to a life that oppresses. That leads to a world of oppression. The oppression, the oppressiveness of a world that is striving for success and for permanence under this fading, passing sun. And that's the message here in chapter 4. You can see that word three times there in verse 1. Oppressions, oppressed, and the oppressors. And so the preacher once again points us at the world, the real world that we know only too well. And he says, look at it, see if you can deny it. So let's walk through this chapter then, and let's see how he confronts us with the oppressiveness of a world filled with people seeking and striving for identity, for recognition, through competitive rivalry with others, and through coveting riches apart from others, and through craving the rule over others. And in each case, he points us to something that is a far better and healthier way. Better, verse 6, a single handful. Verse 9, a sharing outlook. And verse 13, a sane humility. So first, in verses 1 to 6 then, the preacher exposes the oppressiveness of striving for success in terms of achieving prosperity through competitive rivalry with others, which in the end leads only to a very frustrated aggravation. Far better, he says, than this driven competitiveness is a way of detached contentment. A single handful of quietness, verse 6. Not two handfuls with all the toil and the striving after a vanishing wind. The preacher puts his finger on the simple truth that the quest for achievement, for success, leads to oppression, not only for the have-nots of this world, but also, ultimately, for the haves as well. Look at verse 1. It's a pretty good description, isn't it, of our 21st century world, on the local level, on the national level, and also on the global scale. Oppressions, tears of the oppressed, and powerful oppressors. And that is just the nature of a world striving for success. Power on the side of some, and tears among the oppressed. That double refrain, no one to comfort them, no one to comfort them. Well, you see, when you turn God's order for the world upside down, that's what happens. Instead of seeking Him and the joy of an eternal future with Him, people instead are seeking success now for themselves without Him. And so it's a dog-eat-dog world out there. It's not just in our mortality that we're like the beasts, as chapter 3 reminded us so starkly at the end. It's in our behavior as well, he's telling us. Never mind COVID. Think how much modern technology lets the far more pernicious viruses of fear and of greed spread around the world in just a few seconds and cause chaos to people's lives. So you get a central banker in New York making some statement. And within seconds, the bond market and the stock market has tumbled and billions of pounds and dollars are wiped off shares and debt prices and so on. And over-leveraged banks collapse. And even governments can go bust. That's what happened, isn't it, a few years ago with the global financial crisis. And the bad news is that although the banks might be recapitalized and more solvent now, there's barely a government in the world that is remotely solvent. So much worse for the world might be to come. Now, all of that sort of thing seems very far removed from the world of most of us ordinary people, except, of course, when the truth comes home to roost, that the pension pot of the average man in the street has plummeted along with his retirement prospects because of all these international financial machinations. And when we realize that the hopes of our children and our grandchildren of ever actually owning their own home is vanishing because of the rapid asset price inflation, because of all the quantitative easing that's been going on in the world. On the side of the billionaires and on the side of their chums in government, there is power. But for ordinary Joe, well, there's just a lot of tears and no one to comfort him. And that's the so-called free world, isn't it? Never mind the oppression of ordinary people in so many places where gangster politicians or militias are in charge, warlords in many parts of the world, or in places where there is state-controlled tyranny. And the latter seems to be becoming more rapidly the norm, doesn't it? Even in the so-called free world over this last year or so under the cover of COVID. When you begin to think about all the oppressions done under the sun, well, it's hard, isn't it, not to begin to agree with verses 2 and 3 here, that the dead are more fortunate than those who are still alive. It's terrible, isn't it, when you hear people in terrible war-torn places, when you hear them uttering that kind of despair and saying, oh, just to be out of this awful existence. But remember, suicide is the biggest cause of death for young British men. Let that sink in. So oppressive are the evils of this world. And so verse 3, better than both the living and the already dead are those who are not yet born, who haven't yet had to experience the evil in this world. It's quite a thought, isn't it, actually bringing a child into this world, if that's all there is. To experience the relentless rise in psychological ailments among youngsters, and school stress, and then student debt, and then the ongoing empty rat race of life. The preacher's got a point, hasn't he? It's a dog-eat-dog world. He's saying it's a bestial world out there that we inhabit. It's oppressive and it's oppressing. Why? Well, look at verse 4. It tells us the answer, doesn't it? All man's toil, literally his success, that's how skill is translated in chapter 10, verse 10. It's translated as prosperity in chapter 11, verse 6. All a man's toil and success comes from a man's envy of his neighbor. That's what fuels even our best achievements. When the quest for success is what this life is all about. It's sad, isn't it? But it's true. We can't get one up on nature. If we can't get one up on time, we can't beat our mortality, we will jolly well get one up on our neighbor. And that is the real fuel that makes the world go round. It's true at a personal level, however much we might not like to admit it. Keeping up with the Joneses is a big factor of life, isn't it? Somebody once put it this way, spending money we don't have on things we don't need to impress people we don't like. Well, struggling for identity, for recognition through competitive rivalry. Begins very young, doesn't it? We know it with our kids. But Lucy's got one of those, Dad. Why can't I have one? But the toys just get bigger, don't they, as we get bigger and older. That's why the fashion industry cons us out of a fortune. That's why the gadget industry, the motor trade, cons us out of a fortune. But it's not just at a personal level, is it? It's pervasive. It's global. And that's what explains so much of international politics. Churchill's famous quote about Russia, just as pertinent today. I can't forecast to you, he said, the actions of Russia. It's a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. But he went on, but perhaps there is a key, and the key is the Russian national interest. Well, of course, for every country, and it's just as true today for Russia, isn't it? President Putin is smiling as he screws off the gas supplies to Europe, exposes the absurd stupidity of our Western governments that have got rid of all their gas storage, so that in the name of greenness, we're now using electricity that's made by more coal than it has been in the last 20 years. And President Putin's laughing. He's not coming this week. But it's just as true of every country, isn't it? Every powerful regime, envy of neighbor, drives the show. What about Iran and North Korea with their nuclear ambitions? Or China with its phenomenal economic expansion, wanting to overtake the Western world? And it will. Or Britain boasting its faster vaccine rollout than the rest of the European Union. But now, of course, we're leading the European Union on the waning efficacy of our vaccines. Or France, with Mr. Macron's small man syndrome. Likes to strut around, doesn't he, like a peacock. Takes a hissy fit when the Australians don't want to buy submarines anymore, so he's getting his own back by impounding British fishing boats. Or Scotland, where we suffer from small country syndrome a lot of the time, don't we? That drives a kind of niggardly nationalism. It's very unattractive so often. Envy of neighbor, distrust of neighbor is the great driving force everywhere in the world. But don't forget that the preacher here is speaking specifically to God's people, isn't it? The Christian church. We can be just as prone to that same deadly virus of envy, as can you and I. Friends, it's deep in our hearts to be like that. It is our natural inclination. And envy within the Christian church, for what others have, maybe materially, but also in other ways, in terms of positions or roles within the church. That often is one of the biggest causes of resentment and of strife within Christian churches, or between Christian churches. I'll never forget, and you'll be staggered by this, or maybe not. Never forget Rico Tice telling me some years ago that when he was going to the United States to promote the Christianity Explored course, he discovered that churches that they were holding their meetings in weren't advertising to other churches because they didn't want other churches to come and find out about Christianity Explored so they could have an advantage in their evangelism over these other churches. How utterly upside down could you possibly be? That's not just envy, is it? That's hatred of your neighbor. That's oppression. That's demonic oppression. But that's what happens when we abandon God's definition of success in life, and when we seek our own instead. What happens is oppression. Our world rejects God's way. It rejects the Bible's way. Our culture thinks, doesn't it, in our nation today, that it's just enslaving, that it's prejudiced, that the Bible's way should be silenced. Especially the Old Testament law, that's the worst of all, isn't it? Even the church is embarrassed about the Old Testament law. The likes of Leviticus, the great unmentionable. Just have a listen, by the way, just have a listen to a little bit of that dreadful book, Leviticus. You shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him. The wages of a hired servant shall not remain with you all night until the morning. You shall not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall fear your God. I am the Lord. You shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Is it too much obedience to the book of Leviticus that has made our world the mess that it is, do you think? Or is it abandonment, perhaps, for our way instead, a better way of envy-driven success and identity and recognition? Well, the result is oppression, tears and misery for the have-nots, but also for the haves at the end of the day. Look at verse 4 at the end. Even for them, in the end, it's just a striving after wind. So what's the answer? Well, it's not verse 5, a cop-out from life. Stop the world, I want to get off. No, the fool folds his hands, does nothing, gives up, and ends up with nothing, consuming himself, eats his own flesh. Well, some people are driven by the misery of life just to give up on it, aren't they? But that is no answer. No, the answer is in verse 6. Not in competition and covetousness, or in cop-out, for that matter, but in contentment. Better one handful of quietness, peace and contentment, than two hands full of toil and striving after wind. See, true gain in life, he is saying, is not found in drivenness or in disinterest, for that matter, but in detachment, contentment in what you have, not what you don't have. That's the way to peace and satisfaction in life, personally and in the whole of society. The preacher isn't naive. He knows that you can't change the world overnight or even ever. In fact, that idea comes from the same arrogance as the quest for human success. History's offered many ways, hasn't it, to change the world, to rid it of oppression. And it's pretty much always led to a worse evil and a worse oppression. Think of the Marxist revolution in Russia, to liberate the people. Well, it murdered millions of people, impoverished many, many millions more for a long, long time. Now, the preacher won't have any of that fantasy politics to change the world. And the church needs to listen to that too, don't we? Before we jump on the bandwagon of those who want to make poverty history or make any other kind of oppression history. The Bible is very clear to us. That is impossible this side of eternity, under the sun. That doesn't mean, of course, that we don't have a duty to help where we can and do what we can. The abolition of the transatlantic slave trade, for example, 200 years ago, was a Christian-led endeavor, a great thing, and we're right to celebrate that. But we'd be fools, wouldn't we, to think that thereby slavery has somehow been abolished. There's 10 times more slavery in the world today than there was 200 years ago. 10 times more. We can't ever make a utopia under the sun, no matter what we do. That's the preacher's whole point here. Very disappointing to see the Archbishop of Canterbury tweeting just yesterday, as though we can, that we can do it. It's at our fingertips. Well, read Ecclesiastes. Only God can do that in his time. And God will do that. We saw it last time in chapter 3, verse 17. He will judge the righteous and the wicked. But until then, friends, we will never solve this world's problems. And we need to be realistic about that. It doesn't matter how many bigwigs and politicians are going to gather this week down the road there for COP26. Ultimately, they are striving after the wind. And if history is anything to go by, although they'll make some people very rich indeed, they will impoverish many, many more. The tears of the oppressed will continue to flow. What is crooked cannot be made straight by man, says the preacher in chapter 1, verse 15. Do you remember? Because, as we'll see in chapter 7, verse 19, man has sought out many schemes. He is twisted to the core. Jesus Christ was utterly realistic, wasn't he? The poor you will always have with you, he said. That's not an excuse to do nothing, of course, but it is a realism that reminds us that we cannot do everything, or even very much, as human beings. What we can do, of course, is change ourselves. So often, the great grand schemes to change the world for justice, in fact, deflect attention from the one thing that we are called to do, and that is make change in our own lives. To live lives of personal repentance before a God who is sovereign. Jordan Peterson actually is right in that, isn't he, when he makes his quip, before you want to solve the problems of the world, how about starting by tidying your own bedroom? Well, something in that, isn't there? The Bible never gets taken up in vague generalities at the expense of real personal challenge to change ourselves. Jesus said, you are the salt and light for this world. You are to live counterculturally in this world for eternity. That's a real challenge, isn't it, for us as Christian people? Are we living as contented people, cherishing that one handful with peace? Or are we always chasing that second handful all the time, whatever the cost? Whatever the cost to our family, to our marriage, to our friendships, to our Christian discipleship. Does contentedness or competitiveness and covetousness actually mark out our attitude to life in general and to church life? It's a real question. And that's the question that the New Testament is always posing to us. 1 Timothy 6, Paul is writing there to an Ephesian church that he says is full of people who have an unhealthy craving for controversy and quarrels that produce envy, dissension, slander, evil suspicions, and constant friction. And it's in that context that he says the answer to all of that is godliness with contentment. You see, contentment is not just about money, it's about the whole of life. And that's the world, isn't it? Envy, suspicion, friction, slander. And Paul says, and the preacher here says, contentment's the only answer to that. Contentment in who we are, in our identity, and in what we have. It gives us recognition in life. So here's the question. Is the Christian church just a microcosm of the world under the sun? Or does it reflect and radiate the heavenly rays from above the sun in this world? That's a question for us, isn't it? As regarding our own lives and as regarding our church life. It's a real challenge. As are the verses in verses 7 to 12, for the preacher turns to expose the oppressiveness of accumulating possessions through creating riches apart from others, which in the end leads only to alienation, to loneliness. As those who seek to insulate their life through riches, in fact, just isolate themselves from real relationships. But far better, he says, than the miserable riches of covetousness, which, as verse 8 says, leads only to dissatisfaction and deprivation. Far better, he says, are the multiplying riches of community and of companionship, which are truly the path to deliverance and to delight in a reward that is really enduring. Verses 7 and 8, you see, just amplifies the truth that even for the haves in this life, it's an empty and a vain and an ultimately oppressive quest to just chase success in the things that we might amass for ourselves. Because often doing that just insulates you from life and isolates you from the real joys of fellowship and friendship with other human beings and with God, which is the very thing that we're made for as people and what we need in order to flourish as human beings. Verse 8, isolation from others. Literally, somebody who has no second person at all. And insulated from reality, whose eyes are never satisfied with what he has. Not realizing that he's depriving himself in the meantime of so much. And never yet asking himself, well, who am I doing all this for? He's so driven by success, this man, that he's absolutely oblivious, it seems, to everything else in life. Including the fact that it's just making him miserable and isolated. But the world is full of driven people like that, isn't it? Maybe it's the person who gets to the top as they see it, so they can have that great big villa with a big fence and the electric gates that swing shut as soon as they've driven their big gas guzzler in. Well, it won't be a gas guzzler now, will it? It'll be a Tesla. Not even those cheapy Tesla 3s that only cost $40,000, but the really big ones that the bigwigs have. And you can get all of that. You can have your gated house. And you can have your gates swinging shut. You can be safe inside, like a modern-day Ebenezer Scrooge. But what have you got? Someone who is delighting in that kind of thing isn't a master of their own success. That success has mastered him. It owns him. It's driven him to oppression. There's no end to all his toil, it says. It's an unhappy business that's consuming his life. But at least he can feel he's doing better than his neighbor. But that's not much consolation, is it? You're a fool if you think that's success. My father told me about a man that he once knew. He used to scour the daily newspaper in the days when people's, I don't know if it still is, where people's wills and estates were noted in the newspaper. And he used to scour them to see how much of an estate was being left by his friends and compatriots who had died. And he used to love looking at them and saying, I'm going to leave more than he did. But in the end, he actually left just exactly the same as what every one of them did. He left everything, didn't he? All of it. A grim existence to share nothing in life and to leave everything like that in death, isn't it? What's the answer? Well, look at verses 9 to 12. The preacher gives a far better way to live. To live sharing life with other people. Life is not for chasing gain for ourselves, ignoring our neighbor and despising him. Because that's ignoring God, isn't it? And despising Him. No, life is given us for loving God and therefore loving our neighbor. And therefore it's to be marked not by covetousness and containment, contracting out of relationships to protect our possessions or to protect sometimes our personalities or our emotions. Sometimes we cut ourselves off and we store all that up away from other people, don't we? Because we don't want to lose something. But no, look, life is to be marked by companionship and community. Verse 9, two is better than one. And verse 12, three is better still. Life isn't about competition with others. It's for cooperation with others. And the real riches come when you share those things with others. And again, that's true of every level. If you toil for yourself, well, ultimately, he says it brings just misery and oppression for everyone, for those who've got the material gain as well as for those who haven't. But toil together, verse 9, do you see? And it's good for both. They have a good reward, both of them. Even though there's less because it's shared between two, it's better, it's good. In Bible maths, you see, get this very clear, shared less is more. Shared less is more. And that's because there's far more to life than mere things. That's why Jesus said that a man's life doesn't consist in just the abundance of his possessions, or indeed in his successes or achievements. Life consists in right relationships. Indeed, the whole point of the best things in life and the most beautiful things in life is that they're for sharing. Even the smallest children know that, don't they? Mummy, 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 come and see what I've made. Look, look, see what I've made. Sharing. And it's the same, isn't it, for real achievements everywhere in life. Why do musicians play music? To be heard by other people and enjoyed and shared. Why do painters paint beautiful paintings? To be seen and enjoyed and shared with other people. There's something so perverse, isn't there, about the private collector's gallery down in the basement of his mansion where nobody can ever go and see those paintings except him. I think the only thing even more perverse than that is the beautiful painting masterpiece which is kept in a bank vault for nobody to see to protect its value. It has no value in a bank vault. Nobody's seeing it, sharing it. And you see, the same thing holds true in all of life. It holds true in the Christian life and in church life. It's possible to be like a lonely Scrooge there as well. But the New Testament's so against that, so against any concept of the lone Christian. Can't be. It's a contradiction in terms. The Christian church is a community. It's a family. It's God's family. Sharing God's life. And verses 11 and 12 here, you see, are just as true of spiritual life as they are of daily life. There are many obstacles to face. And alone, there is real danger. But together, he says, we'll be able to withstand an enemy. A threefold cord is not easily broken. But let me tell you, a lone Christian can be easily broken. Christian fellowship is a blessing, but it's an essential blessing. And you need it. So does your brother. So does your neighbor. You need to be realistic about the blessings of fellowship and relationships in your Christian walk. If you're somebody who is apt to contain yourself, who tends to contract out of relationships, who tends to think that, well, I'm quite self-sufficient on my own, let me tell you, friends, the Bible tells you you're wrong. You're wrong about that. And many folk have been deceived about that, I think, particularly over these last 18 months. Let me be quite clear. Online alone is just alone if you're a Christian. Don't contract out. That's not success. You need to play your part in cooperating in the community life of God's people for your own sake and for their sake. It's a shared life. And that's real success. That's real achievement. That's real gain in life. That is what you are made for. We're not made for the miserable riches of covetousness, but for the multiplying riches of community. Not for solitude, but for sharing. And above all, for sharing the life of God and sharing the life of his people here on earth. But finally, in verses 13 to 16, they make the same point by exposing the oppression of striving for your identity or recognition in life by advancing your popularity, craving the rule over other people, which again so often just leads to arrogance and losing touch with our personal limitations. Far better, he says, than craving rule and leadership of others is to be cautious about the responsibilities that that brings and to be conscious continually of your own limitations so as not to become like that old and foolish king who no longer knows how to take advice. That's a very important word, isn't it? For world leaders, well, for church leaders too. The preacher's now looking here, isn't he, at the very top of the tree, the world of kings, of national rulers. Surely to rise to the throne, to the presidential palace, that really must be the ultimate success. But look at verse 16. No, in the end, that too is just a vain striving after wind. Better indeed, he says, verse 13, to be a poor and wise youth who stays that way than to think that. The translation in this paragraph, as I said, is a little bit unclear, but the point is that this first one king who rises up to the top from nothing, verse 14. It's a parable, this. It's not talking history. It's like a fairy tale. He goes from prison to the throne. This is Disney at its best. But, very quickly, the trappings of office seem to do their work, don't they? And power corrupts. And he ends up, verse 13, old and foolish and arrogantly out of touch with reality. Thinks himself omnipotent. That's a tale that's very close to reality, isn't it? And so verse 15, along comes another, literally a second youth, to stand in his place. The next leader, who now everyone under the sun is with. Literally, they're supporting him. Well, that's how it happens, isn't it? Every new president, every new prime minister is a messiah. They're going to make the country great again. Well, things can only get better. Remember that one? But what happens? Well, just goes the same way in the end. Look at verse 16. No one will rejoice in him either in time. His leadership will end up burdensome, sapping. Verse 16 echoes verse 8. Verse 8, there was no end of all that man's toil. The more he accumulated riches and so on. Well, here, verse 16, there was no end of all the people. Likewise, burdening this one who was seeking advancement and recognition through his rule. No sooner have you got to the top than being at the top gets to you. You'll trample, you'll kill for success, but very quickly success will trample and kill you. And we see it all the time, don't we, in the world of business and power and politics and so on. The new bright leader comes along, always thinks he's the one who will break the mold. He'll lead forever. He'll be invincible. But the truth is, that kind of success in terms of popular power and leadership is just another burden. It's another oppression. No end of all the people that he led. And every one of them a critic in the end. Well, that's real life at the top, isn't it? And his legacy, verse 16, those who come after him will not rejoice in him. Well, that's the truth. And nowadays, eventually, if enough time passes, your statue will be pulled down, won't it? Because you weren't woke enough, like Winston Churchill wasn't when he won the war for us. So pull his statue down. It doesn't take long, does it? Certainly doesn't take that length of time to fade away from favor, to fade away from memory. Don't hear very much at all now, do we, of the former Prime Minister David Cameron or Gordon Brown? Or that much about Mr. Trump, or even Mr. Obama, who gave all those dazzling speeches in his time. But in fact, well, left a pretty grim legacy, didn't he? Chaos in Syria and Libya, so-called Arab Spring very quickly turned to winter, occupied Crimea. Not a lot of rejoicing in these places. So those who do crave that kind of power, that kind of rule, they might reflect better on verse 13. Perhaps better to remain an unheard of, poor and wise youth, not craving popularity and power through rule over others, or any other kind of leadership for that matter, including church leadership, by the way. James the Apostle says exactly that, doesn't he? Not many of you should become teachers because you'll be judged with greater strictness. Of course, he means by God, but also by the no end of people who will judge you too. That's reality. Church leadership just like anywhere else. So be careful about craving that kind of burden. Far better to be cautious and canny. Better a poor and wise youth who remained like that and wasn't ruined by elevation to what he thought was going to be the pinnacle of success. I wonder how many politicians' families would echo that. If only he'd never become a government minister. I wonder if Matt Hancock's family thinks that today. Would the young Lady Diana Spencer, do you think, have traded her former life for the no end of people and the paparazzi that did in the end actually kill her? Would she have done that had she really known? I wonder. Or many another poor but happy, normal person who these days gets elevated to the ranks of so-called celebrity, the people who are famous just for being famous, reality TV and all that. But in the end, wondering, what's the lasting profit in this? There's profit, certainly, in the luxury rehab clinics and all the therapists that they have to turn to. I don't suppose many of us really crave that kind of life, do we? But it's easy, actually, to be driven people. Driven for success in life. And often driven by success, our desire for success in Christian terms. We can delude ourselves that way. And drive ourselves, therefore, to oppression. Sometimes to depression. Achieving what we think is prosperity. What we think is worth possessing. Advancing what we think is popularity. But you see, if that's how we're living our lives, friends, we are just mirroring life under the sun, as if there was nothing more. And the preacher's reminded us, hasn't he, how much more there is. And of the day that real success will be measured by the only measure that matters at all. On the day when, as he said in chapter 3, verse 17, God will judge. God will judge the righteous and the unrighteous. And only if we live day by day, every day, conscious of that and clear on that, only then will we be breathing the real oxygen of reality that can actually energize us and can motivate us now for what really matters in these passing lives on earth. Not coveting and consuming for ourselves, but content and at peace with others. Not competing with our neighbor, but cooperating in companionship and community in the church and in the world. And not craving elevation over other people, but being cautious and canny about the reality of the fickle human heart and realistic about the burdens that no end of people brings, just as no end of toil brings it. That's the answer to living in a fallen world, a world of oppression and oppressiveness and oppressors. We can't change it. To think that we can is pure fantasy, chasing the wind. Just as illusory as chasing lasting success and achievement in this world. But if we live like this with realism, we will change some of it. Beginning with the greatest need of all, which is in our own hearts. And as the preacher says, far better to be content with one handful of what is possible than striving for two and ending up with nothing, just chasing the wind. Well, maybe there is a word there for COP 26. But certainly, there's a world for every one of us, isn't there? So may God help us not be like old and foolish rulers, but be wise and take heed and listen. Let's pray. Godliness with contentment is great gain. Lord, may we know both contentment and joy in all our lives and in all our work. just because in them we find your presence and your purpose for our lives here on earth. And so may we, by being faithful and cheerfully obedient to your word, may we be those who prove your good and perfect will in all that we think, in all that we speak, and in all that we do, for the glory of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.